Thank you, Virginia. Next, we have Philip Magnus, who is Director of Research and Education at the American Institute for Economic Research. He's also a research fellow at the Independent Institute, holds a PhD and MPP from George Mason University's School of Public Policy, and a BA from the University of St. Thomas in Houston. Dr. Magnus taught at American University, George Mason, and Berry College. His work encompasses the economic history of the United States and the Atlantic world, with specializations in the economic dimensions of slavery and racial discrimination, the history of taxation, and measurements of economic inequality over time. In addition to his scholarship, his popular writings have appeared in numerous venues, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Newsweek, Politico, Reason, National Review, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. He will speak on Marxism and the intellectuals.
Good morning, everyone. You may have noticed that that title is an homage to an earlier essay by the great economist and early member, distinguished member of the society, Friedrich Hayek, called The Intellectuals and Socialism. And I want to start with a quote from that essay. Hayek wrote in 1949, "Socialism has never and nowhere been at first a working class movement. It's a construction of theorists deriving from certain tendencies of abstract thought for which, for a long time, only intellectuals were familiar, and it required long efforts by those intellectuals before the working classes could be persuaded to adopt their program." Hayek's words remain true 75 years later, and I'm here to talk about one such socialist who enjoys immense intellectual favor among the intellectuals, and that is Karl Marx. In 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union heralded the defeat of Marxism, which was widely proclaimed at that moment. Marx's theories left a catastrophic toll of over 100 million dead, massive impoverishment worldwide, dozens of authoritarian political regimes in their wake, and a legacy of economic and human immiseration. We recently marked the 30th anniversary of that event, and while Marxism's failures are impossible to deny, the intellectual classes have, over that period, re-embraced Karl Marx the man, even attempting to separate him from his system's deadly legacy in its 20th century iterations. In 2018, the 200th anniversary of Karl Marx's birth, intellectual elites showered him with praise. Headlines in the Financial Times declared, quote, "Karl Marx is more relevant than ever." The austere New York Times said, "Happy birthday, Karl Marx. You were right." The statistics from academia paint an even more disturbing figure. In 2013, the scientific journal Nature conducted a study of Google Scholar's citation database, weighting all important intellectual figures from history across the sciences, humanities, social sciences, and fine arts to determine who was the single most influential author. The answer was Karl Marx. In 2020, according to the Open Syllabus Project, which aggregates university syllabi across the United States and the world, and is sortable by discipline and all sorts of other metrics, Marx's Communist Manifesto ranks the single most frequently assigned work by a philosopher on university course syllabi. Second, Plato's Republic. Third, fourth, and fifth fall hundreds of places below where Karl Marx is said in terms of the number of syllabi appearances. The only things that outnumber him consistently are the Strunken White Grammar Manual and a widely used mathematics textbook, neither of which are particularly philosophical works. And to add one more recent statistic, the Higher Education Research Institute's survey of faculty just released its advanced data for the 2019-2020 survey, had the disturbing figure, whereas 60% of all college faculty in the United States identify as some form of the political left, approximately 13% of those identify on the radical or far left, the Marxian left and all of its derivatives. Conservatives of all stripe, ranging from classical liberal libertarian to traditionalist conservative to anything in between. A mere 10% of university faculty. The Marxists outnumber us in the university system. Marx's influence today is not just confined to the pervasiveness of Marxist economics, surprisingly outside of economics departments. Indeed, it remains relatively obscure in economics departments. But Marxism has spawned dozens of schools of thought in history, philosophy, sociology, literature, art, architecture, and anything with the name studies attached to it. Marxist-inspired movements now include literary criticism, post-colonial studies, critical theory, as we've heard about, entire disciplines that in Marx's age and for many decades afterward were never even considered part of the purview of his work. My purpose today, though, is to ask why Karl Marx's reputation is so resilient among the intellectuals, and in doing so, ask why Karl Marx even has a reputation at all. In Marx's own lifetime, he was never anything more than a fringe figure, confined to the radical labor activist circles that he operated in. He died in relative obscurity in 1883. Only a dozen people attended his funeral, and it was only noticed because Frederick Engels, his wealthy friend, telegrammed it out to the world to try to elicit obituary notices. For three decades that followed after Marx's death, his principles were almost universally rejected by other intellectuals, especially economists, basically the only group that paid any attention to him whatsoever. The marginal revolution of 1871 rendered Marx's Das Kapital obsolete only 4 years after it was published. If you want to talk about an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, read Das Kapital. Marx built his entire theory, though, around the labor theory of value. His economic framework depended on accepting that economic value arises from labor performed. The capitalist and Marxist system then appropriates surplus value of the laborer as his own, a process that Marx deems exploitative. Eventually, labor uprisings emerge in the form of a proletarian revolution to seize the means of production and usher in a communist age. All rests on this doctrine of surplus value, except surplus value was a myth. As Karl Menger and William Stanley Jevons demonstrated in 1871, value does not arise from labor performed. It's necessarily subjective, arising from individual preferences, and individuals value goods on the margin. When mainstream economics first seriously engaged Karl Marx, it happened 2 years after his death. In 1885, the marginalist economist Philip Wicksteed published a devastating critique of Marx's Das Kapital. It was about 6 pages long and dissected a 1,000-page book. The hits on Marx kept piling up from there. When Alfred Marshall published his landmark Principles of Economics textbook, the first modern economics textbook in 1890, he discussed and then dismissed Marx's system. It is, quote, he argued, a complete circle of erroneous theories of value, hiding its sleight of hands by keeping it, quote, shrouded in mysterious Hegelian phrases. Eugen von Bumbiverk wrote a book-length rebuttal and dissection of Marx's system in 1897 that immediately became something of an economics bestseller, translated from German into English 3 years later. In 1907, the Economic Journal, then the leading economics journal in the world, was asked to review a new translation of the second volume of Das Kapital. Reviewer C. Violet Butler openly mocked its obsolescence by likening it to Don Quixote's Imagined Monsters, stating, quote, who should tilt as such a windmill as this? John Maynard Keynes, no right winger, reached similar conclusions in 1925, dismissing Marx's Capital as, quote, an obsolete textbook without interest or application to the modern world. Ludwig von Mises called the same book essentially a garbled rehash of David Ricardo, as did Paul Samuelson, the 20th century Keynesian economist, in his 1962 presidential address to the American Economic Association. He stated, from the viewpoint of pure economic theory, Karl Marx can be regarded as a minor post-Ricardian. The message has been clear since the turn of the century. Economists had seriously considered Marx's arguments in the first 3 decades that followed his death and soundly rejected them as obsolete. Harvard's Thomas Nixon Carver summarized this view in 1922, stating that no economist today accepts a single one of the dogmas of Marx. His materialistic interpretation of history is rejected even by most other socialists. His labor theory of value is antiquated and inadequate, and his theory of surplus value is childish. In the humanities and other social sciences, Marxism was basically a non-entity at this point in history, not even cited, discussed, or noted in any depth. Yet in 2023, the patterns have changed. Marx remains rejected in most economics journals, save for passing references in the history of economic thought, Yet in sociology, philosophy, political theory, and law, Marx is now everywhere. Literature has entire subfields dedicated to Marxist analysis, and education theory has been overwhelmed by the critical pedagogy movement of Marxist revolutionary writer Paulo Freire, the most commonly assigned text in graduate schools of education today. In the past 120 years, Marx has moved from obscure obsolescence into the core of the academic intellectual mainstream. And I want to ask the question of why. The answer I propose is traces to one specific event, and that is the violent seizure of the Russian government in a coup d'etat in 1917 by a small band of Marxist intellectuals, the very type that Hayek described. This event led to the creation of the Soviet Union and subsequent propagandizing of Marxist doctrine across the intellectual world. I'm not the first to suggest this explanation. Frederick Charles Copleston noticed this in his landmark History of Philosophy, suggesting that Marx owed his entire reputation not to the merits of his ideas, but to the political violence of his progeny, as did others, including on the political left. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1933 that until the Russian Revolution, Karl Marx was little known in America. Today, at last, we all know better, he proudly proclaimed. H.G. Wells, a non-Marxian socialist, observed that same year that Marx's, quote, accidental selection as the ostensible creed of revolutionary Russia after the Tsarist collapse gives it an almost primary importance in the history of kinetic ideas. Or there's also my favorite, though not of the left, the British naval historian C. Northcote Parkinson, observed in 1967 that Marx in his own time was so obscure he did not even attract or merit the attention of the police. Nonetheless, today he is elevated in the wake of the Soviet Revolution. Modern Marxists flee from the Soviet legacy precisely because they know the body count. But I'll offer you an empirical demonstration that the two are inseparable. And you'll find on your tables there are a handful of handouts that show some data, put some data to the track and trajectory of Karl Marx over time. Some of the charts that I present to you include data from Google's Ngram project, a massive ongoing effort to scan and digitize the texts of the world's great libraries using the Ngram database. I worked recently with economist Michael McCovey to assemble a yearly Ngram record of citations for 220 important intellectual figures and obscure socialists alike covering the mid-19th century to the present day. Our hypothesis was straightforward. The Soviet Union rescued Marx from relative obscurity in 1917 and thrust him into the intellectual mainstream. If this is indeed the case, we should expect Marx's citation patterns to parallel other relatively obscure socialists from the time between his death in 1883 until 1916. After 1917, they should skyrocket, even overtaking prominent figures such as Adam Smith, which is basically where Marx's pattern stands today. And you can see exactly that. In a citation-matched synthetic Karl Marx, we can closely track his citations prior to 1917. After 1917, he diverges from the composite socialists that contributed that. Such notable figures as Ferdinand LaSalle and Johann Karl Rodbertus being his primary contemporaries of note. Our results are robust and clear. But in addition to seizing power, Lenin and the Bolsheviks ignited a philosophical elevation of Karl Marx into the broader intellectual mainstream. Just over a decade after 1917, Marx's citations increased sharply, approximately threefold, and then it was off to the races from there. And that pattern has only continued. By contrast, the synthetic counterfactual Marx lingers in relative obscurity, as do its composite authors, LaSalle and Rodbertus. But our story does not end there. Another event happened in 1923 that modern-day academic Marxists used to dissociate themselves from the crimes of Lenin, Stalin, and Mao. And that is the year of the founding of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, which gave birth to the Western Marxist tradition. Except it's not so separate after all. At the inaugural lecture series of the Frankfurt School in 1923, German Marxist philosopher Karl Korsch made this clear. He announced to the seminar that, quote, what Lenin has done in Russia in the field of Marxist theory is to liberate it from the inhibiting traditions of social democracy of the second period. Korsch later became a critic of Stalinism, but nonetheless made his homage very clear. Unlike the class analysis of Orthodox Marxism, though, the critical theorists took an explicit cultural turn. They recognized the same paradox that Hayek had noticed in his essay. The laboring masses seldom, if ever, act as if Karl Marx would predict. Instead, intellectuals, namely them, must exist to lead the charge. A charge through culture, educational institutions, even business itself. They did so by positioning themselves as diagnostic commentators on, quote, traditional theory, pre-designating it in a conspiracist fashion as a constructed intellectual paradigm to service the power of the haves over the have-nots. That was Max Horkheimer's charge in coining critical theory in dialectical juxtaposition in the early 1930s. But like Marx, the critical theorists initially went nowhere. You'll see that on the other side of the handout. I'll call your attention to the second graph showing engram references to a sample of major Frankfurt School critical theorists and thinkers, Herbert Marcuse, Max Horkheimer, Theodore Adorno in particular, as well as the next generation that followed them. They lingered unnoticed from the time they started writing in the early 1920s until seizing upon the radical left activism of the academy in the mid-1960s. And now they are everywhere, desperately projecting disaffiliation from the legacy of any Soviet forebear. I offer a diagnosis of the same 1960 movement by an original attendee of that 1923 seminar at the Frankfurt School, Carl August Wittfogel. Wittfogel turned on Marxism, and in giving a lecture, reflecting on his life, reflecting on everything he observed, he noted that if the Bolshevik Revolution had failed, Marx today would be remembered by only a handful of social scientists and an ever-decreasing number of socialists. Which is an interesting observation. In that case, the disintegration of Orthodox Marxism, which Wittfogel predicted would now be occurring even in the non-communist world, would surely have been much more rapid. But according to Wittfogel, Lenin's party prevailed in 1917, and communist power expanded enormously. It is mainly for this reason, he continued, that Marx, as the symbol of the gigantic success story, is today widely known for what he said and did, and even more widely known for what he did not say and did not do. How did these events play out? At first, it was likely curiosity. In 1917, as newspapers around the world picked up Marx's works in an attempt to understand and decipher the quirky dead philosopher whose followers had just seized control of one of the world's great powers. But as Lenin and his successors also devoted the full energy of the Soviet state to promoting, propagandizing, and disseminating Marxist doctrine. Lenin immediately ordered and subsidized the translation and publication of Marx's collected works. He built a personality cult around Marx, the man with statutes and propaganda posters. They mandated Marxist instruction in schools and universities under the control. They subsidized other Marxist movements around the globe. In a militaristic campaign, they matched or exceeded any other imperialist regime in the 20th century, if not human history. This pattern has been observed not only by critics of Marx, but by the eminent Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm, who noted that it was not until Lenin devoted the full treasury of the Soviet state into propagandizing Marx that his works became a common household name. And thus we reach the inescapable truth. Even in non-Soviet Western Marxists, such as the Frankfurt School and its critical theory outgrowths today, though notoriously schismatic from doctrinaire Marxism, indeed, other Marxists hate the critical theory Marxists with greater fervor and vigor than almost any other movement. Unfortunately, there are a lot of collaterals whenever they collide. But they nonetheless owe their very existence to the aftermath of 1917 and Marx's intellectual reputation. As does fellow traveler Antonio Gramsci, who penned a paean to Lenin in 1917 despite his own latter attempts to disassociate himself from that particular iteration of the cause in his own plotting of an alternative course, a long march through institutions rather than a revolutionary upheaval led by a proletarian army. Gramsci wrote in 1917, if the Bolsheviks reject some of that which is affirmed by Das Kapital, they do not reject its inherent invigorating Marxist ideas. They are not Marxist theoreticians. They, quote, live out Marxist thought in their lives, the one which will never die. Please note that I am not saying that all Marxists today learned everything that they know and espouse from Lenin and Stalin, or that the Soviet version of Marxism is a secret undergirding of every Marxist movement. It is not. But Marx's own reputation itself is inextricably connected to the Bolshevik Revolution. The revolution that rescued him from obscurity and put his name on the intellectual map. Marxism today stands on Lenin and Stalin's shoulders, whether it wishes to admit this reality or not. In considering this counterfactual, around 1917, we might imagine another world in which the Soviets did not succeed. One in which Marx would still be studied, but as a heterodox figure on the outskirts of intellectual life, a figure among many other competing socialist traditions in that fringe of the intellectual canon. But perhaps also a much more diverse variety of socialists. No thanks to 1917, Marxism emerged as the dominant socialist tradition and effectively sidelined and crowded out its main competitors in its own ranks. Fast forward to today, we find another unsettling development. Marx has not only attained a hegemonic presence among other socialist theorists, he has attained a form of hegemonic presence in intellectual life, as evidenced in what is produced out of many of our universities, placing pressure on all other competitor philosophies and displacing almost all other traditions, liberalism, conservatism, pluralism, as the favored approach in many academic disciplines. Curiously, the track record of his system's implementation has done almost nothing to diminish his post-1917 stature. Rather, historical amnesia surrounds the atrocity of his followers, as it does the endless stream of dissociation and excuse-making around all of their failures. The Soviet Union, Maoist China, Kim's North Korea, Pol Pot's Cambodia, Castro's Cuba, Chavez and Maduro's Venezuela, and countless other deadly authoritarian regimes, all carried out explicitly in Marx's name and celebrated at their inception by Marxists, are now casually dismissed and dissociated in their destructive aftermaths. We are told they were not true socialism or true Marxism. And yet, it falls to the next socialist regime every time to implement Marx the right way. Yet as our evidence shows, the attempts to dissociate Marx from Marxism's track record is simply not a convenient rhetorical ploy. It's historically false and impossible. I cannot claim to know the exact course of the 20th century in the absence of a Marxist-inspired Bolshevik uprising, including whether other revolutionary uprisings would have occurred or who they would claim as their intellectual inspirations and forebears. But the history is clear. The deadly, illiberal, and tyrannical events of 1917 secured Marx's place in the intellectual canon, a place where he remains today, irrespective of the merits of his track record. When Marxist intellectuals today attempt to separate themselves from the history of Marxism in practice in the 20th century, they deny a central reason for the continued salience of Marx's idea. 1917 is their legacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. Now I'm even more depressed. So.